And so they have a key change. Wings, listen to what the man said. Something you might actually echo if you find yourself in a legal advisory situation and you sort of think, well, I'd actually like to sort of avail myself of the work of Newton's solicitors in many ways. We're delighted now to welcome a new voice to Siren FM's Midweek Drive, and Midweek Drive Morning Edition and so on, and a gentleman who sadly missed us when we were actually at the Great Yorkshire Show last week, but his wife Sarah did a sensational interview to such an extent we thought, well, we must feature Chris Newton as well. So, Chris Newton, good morning. How are you?
Hi there. Very well, thank you.
Use Newtons and you'll get the cream. I showed the advertisements to Professor Jane Chapman and she said, are they selling strawberries? Well, after a fashion, I'm sure. But share with us, Chris, a little bit about Newtons and how, within 5 years, you've become pretty much a preeminent law firm within the Yorkshire County.
Well, thank you very much. And yes, we like to think so. And we get lots of people saying the same thing to us, and we are now seen as a regional practice. And as you say, all in 5 years. We set up the business 5 years ago. Good things come out of the recession. I never thought I would set up my own business, but got to the stage when I thought, you know what, I think I can do better on my own. So set up literally as a one-man band, no big plans, and yet in 5 years, we've now just opened our eighth office. We have nearly 70 people as part of the team, and more people looking to join literally every month.
Because there was a day when solicitors couldn't promote themselves legally.
Different world now.
Different century, Jane. Exactly. It's all working through that. Yeah. I must admit, Chris, I was very impressed with your little mini editorial in the latest edition of Living North Good Food 2014, which concludes, food is a vital part of Yorkshire's culture, and this guide can help you find the perfect place to enjoy a special occasion, which is wonderful from that point of view. And the opening routine, eating out in good restaurants is one of my favourite pastimes, and I'm always interested in hearing about the latest great places to eat in the region. There are so many. Obviously, there are lots in Lincolnshire as well, because, you know, this morning, obviously, we're based in Lincolnshire. We need to, obviously, flag that up. We don't want people suddenly saying, those Yorkshire people, they're not trying to infiltrate by stealth once again.
No. We will hopefully come down to Lincolnshire fairly soon.
There we are, right. You see. It's very exciting.
Always looking for the opportunity.
And any relation to Sir Isaac, we have to ask.
Well, he was cleverer than I am, but no, afraid not.
Chris, in terms of that shift and obviously setting up your own business, as you said, coming out of the recession and so on, just share with us a little bit of your own backstory in terms of have you always gone into the law? Because we've spoken to an awful lot of legal people who have had a major career change, they've adjusted it, and then others obviously have a passion for the whole thing and literally go on to do all sorts of things, and they've always had a sort of sense of areas of the law. And also, perhaps, which area do you specialise in, or is it the wonderful world of generalisation?
Well, I was on the conveyor belt, like so many people were. You go through school, A-levels, do a degree, go to law school, get a job as a solicitor, and I always felt that there was something more that I wanted. And my wife and I, we were looking for other business opportunities, and we looked at several different things, and it never really occurred to me to say, well, look, you know, look at your own trade and look at setting up what you do, which is a law firm. So I was a solicitor in three firms, then became a partner in the third firm and got full equity. And so having a share in a business made it such a huge decision to walk away from that and set up on our own. There were lots of sleepless nights. My wife was saying to me, are you sure you know what you're doing? And I was saying, yep, think so.
It's always very supportive when you get that sort of line. Are you sure you know what you're doing? It depends on the phrasing, of course, obviously.
Well, you know, as you will appreciate and so many other people will appreciate, that there is so much riding on it. You've you are in a secure job. You've got family. You've got mortgage. And the thought of setting up on your own and not being totally certain as to when the next money is going to come in, because you're not going to get your monthly paycheck because you're in your own business, and it all relies on you to generate that cash, It is nerve-wracking.
It is nerve-wracking. I can actually endorse that. I had my own business.
14 years, Jane. Yes, 14 years.
Television production, independent producer. And we found it was a kind of a roller coaster because when we had contracts, they were longish, you know, television series as opposed to one-off. And so you'd have the money then to do things. And then the contract finished and you were left with nothing. And so there was, you didn't really know how, you know, how far to plan ahead and what commitments to take on.
Yeah.
And it's particularly worrying when you've got young kids and a mortgage.
And people say things to you at certain times in your life and certain things stick. And I remember a friend of mine saying that when you're in business on your own, the highs will be higher, but the lows will be lower.
And it
can be very lonely at times. But equally, you know, let's look on the positive side. We've fortunately made a huge success of what we're doing, and there are lots of highs.
Yes, that's great. Well, long may it continue.
Thank you very much.
Intrigued to find the connection between yourself and Javen Liam. Javen, of course, we've worked with for a few years. A fantastic photographer, develops all sorts of things. Responsible for the strawberries, which I'm sure we'll put a link on the website as well.
You can see those
exactly in every sense of the word.
Yep.
But that struck me as really quite a fascinating symbiotic relationship. Really, when we connected, as we mentioned with your wife Sarah at the Great Yorkshire Show. How did you find the event yourself? I mean, was it the first time? In fact, share with us why involve a wonderful creative photographer within the Newton's work?
Well, when you're trying to project the business, there are so many lawyers out there, so many people jumping up and down saying, me too, and you've got to think, well, how do I get across, how do I differentiate myself from everybody else that's out there? And we are keen on our marketing, and I think we were in a pub having some lunch and we saw some photos on display and they were Javen's, and I said, you know what, I like the look of those, why don't we get in touch with that guy and see if he can do some photos for us for our marketing. And we really hit it off. We are good friends now, and we are continually working on marketing campaigns together, and it's just such a good relationship. We will have ideas, we'll kick them around, we'll spit them out, kick them around, and they will evolve until you get the finished product, such as the adverts that you saw that were generated for the Yorkshire Show.
Let's be honest, Chris, without Javen Liam, you wouldn't be on the Midweek Drive Morning Edition this morning, you say. So
well...
I mean, we do. Yesterday, of course, on the afternoon production, the Midweek Drive evening version, we had one of the partners from Wilkin Chapman Grange. Mm-hmm. Don't worry, Jane, it's not gone all legal, but it's just, I always like to cover all bases from that point of view. Mm-hmm. That was Claire Parker. And again, we've encountered Claire through a variety of sort of areas, but it is something where, certainly in terms of the communication side of things, communicating with clients and barristers, judges, the whole legal process, it is part of that whole process. You do need to communicate, Chris, as an important part of the job.
It's key, isn't it? And that's what it's all about. But just going back to your last question, I guess, having a law firm, the lawyers, the solicitors, people who are qualified solicitors aren't always the best people to be managing every aspect of that business. So if we had a solicitor who was very good at the legals trying to do marketing, they just don't necessarily have that creative flair. So let's get the best people for the job. And Javen is the best person for our marketing role.
There we are. So a couple of quick wrapping up questions, Chris. Influencers in terms of who inspired you to go into the legal profession? Was it Perry Mason? Was it Ali McBeal? Was it LA Law? Was it a media based thing?
It's probably a bit of a boring answer. It was my dad. He was a police officer. I was thinking of going into the police force, and he said, "No, you want to become a solicitor. They make loads of money."
Well, I mean, coming from a police officer, I mean, that's interesting. So, sort of says it, really. Jade, any other questions that you have for Chris about life and times and obviously Newton's, which we'll give it newtons.co.uk. There we are.
Is your bread and butter conveyancing and the property market?
Well, we started out as litigation practice. I'm a litigator by trade. So representing people in court, getting people out of trouble, helping them if they've got a problem. But we very quickly found that we were referring a lot of work to other law firms who also did litigation, and we thought that our clients might forget that we're their litigation lawyers. So we started branching out, getting people in to do the different areas. And you're quite right, now the strength in the business is our property work. And we've got 13 residential property solicitors. It's a very strong area.
And how is the property market in Yorkshire at the moment?
Very strong. Very strong.
Oh,
I think it's taking off all over. Friends in other parts of the country, they also relate to me. Yes, the property is really picking up now after some very worrying years through the recession.
Yeah.
Chris, as we just acknowledged, you have bucked that trend and done extraordinarily well. Chris, it's been fabulous touching base with yourself today.
Thank you for having me on.
Well, there are two final critical questions, which are crucial in every sense of the word. First of all, have you had a reasonably interesting telephonic link with us today, Chris Newton?
I've had an excellent telephonic link
this
with you. Thank you very much.
This is our customer satisfaction survey, and as Jane will attest to in
they're
academia...
They're frightened to say no, Alex.
No. See, the NSS student surveys, we're always looking at them. So the next critical question, Chris, is can we look forward to featuring you again in the not-too-distant future and hopefully seeing you in person in the very near future as well?
You certainly can. I look forward to it.
Polyphonic Spree, Light and Day, Siren 107.3 FM, Professor Jane Chapman on the Madrid Drive Morning Edition with Alex Levchuk. That's almost the first hour done, Jane.
Well, it went very quickly.
Well, there we are in the second hour. Ian Lennox, journalist and producer and writer, joins us. We'll also be speaking to William Sitwell, and hopefully Andy Jones will be joining us. We might also have an organic baker online as well. That will probably manifest itself in the fullness of time. A brief mention for one of the events that John Wenham's put together from his events diary at the Heckington Showground on Saturday the 26th of July and Sunday the 27th of July. It's the 147th Heckington Show. Nothing quite matches the Heckington Show for the relaxed way that it combines the intimacy of a village show with the expectation of the national stage. Heckington Show is a true family day out, a quintessentially English summer occasion for families and friends to enjoy and take part in an event that brings competition and cooperation, pride and pleasure, sunshine and smiles to a summer's day. Sounds wonderful. Tickets,
yes.
£8 for adults and children, £3. That's the Heckington Show, the 147th Heckington Show, Saturday the 26th of July and Sunday the 27th of July.
Sounds good. Hello, this is Jane Clark, the historian at Aintree Racecourse, and you're listening to the Midweek Drive Morning Edition with Alex Levchuk.
Must be something to do with the Christian name Jane, obviously. Jane, a historian of the Grand National and founder of the Aintree Grand National Museum. And, of course, Jane Chapman, comparative media
historian.
Exactly. It's wonderful. Weather today, highs of 24 degrees centigrade, lows of 16 degrees centigrade. A fine and settled day with light winds and some sunny spells. Much like one of your novels, Ian Lennox. Isn't that right? You know, fine and dry with a few sunny spells.
I was never that hot.
Welcome along to the production at the slightly different time, just after 9 o'clock, as opposed to 8:40. But Ian, obviously one of the reasons we were delighted to feature you again this week is because prior to you heading off again to Canada, we wanted to focus very much on the brothers. And for the benefit of Professor Jane Chapman, who is in the studio, as you just heard, perhaps you'd like to share with us what the focus of the brothers is, because it all ties in with the Great War.
Oh, yes. Well, I started writing about 30 odd years ago, and I had an idea to write about two brothers who live in a remote community, and the thing gradually evolved in research until I started to write a book about two different sorts of people who were brothers, one who loved the land and the other who was obviously very ambitious to go and work in the city, and they're both very able people, and when war broke out, one of them went to live in the wilds rather than fight in the war, and the other went to fight at the front. And the story was about how they both tried to survive. Mm. But on a broader theme, it was obviously how a huge event like the war can overtake a small community, and they're just powerless to live their normal lives.
I've already eulogised about the wonderful narrative that you got in The Brothers, and I will pass on a copy to Jane to have a little perusal from that point of view.
But
Jane, again, you're saying from the perspective of the historical narrative, your thoughts on this, obviously using the backdrop of the Great War as how it impacts on lives?
Well, I think it's obviously a tremendously important world-shattering event to have as a backdrop. And a lot of novelists have done it really successfully. And my favourite is Pat Barker. But I think Ian's idea is tremendous, because you can appreciate the period at several levels then, can't you? With Ian's thing. It's the relationship with the brothers and the personal side. It's the rural thing and the community and what's happening around them. So there's three or four different layers.
Yes.
And that's always a tremendous ingredient for a novel, I think.
Actually, funny enough, the book does, Alex will tell you, it does explore those themes, exactly. Strange.
it's called getting the right casting together for the show, Ian. You should know that when you're talking to the producer at Time Tees.
Well, I have to say, I haven't read it, but I've assessed it correctly, although I haven't read it. That's good.
You could probably write a review of it now.
and how often the vivors exist on that basis alone, really, but still, no. So it's a whole range of things. Looking at Gentlemen and Players, of course, the latest opus that came through, I just read a short little excerpt from this. Again, it's the opening sequence. Ben watched the retreating figure in silence. He wanted to tell the king that, in fact, he didn't sleep well in his bed. At least twice a week he was chased awake by a nightmare in which he was trapped in a web and stalked by a huge black spider. His father had died, caught on the huge rolls of razor wire that guarded the trenches at the edge of no man's land, the wire which they'd said we'd be blown to pieces by the shells, but which had in fact been blown into the air, only to land tangled and more impenetrable than ever. It's just a very short little snippet there, but is that something in which you discover that, you know, the official line to the troops were that it's all gone, it's all going to be flattened, etc., but effectively that wasn't the case?
Well, this is much more Jane's theory than mine, but I as I understand it, one of the themes of the World War was the technology of the war had advanced quicker than the tactics.
Yes.
So no one really understood how to fight the damn thing. There'd been a pressing precursor of that during the American Civil War, I think, when there was trench warfare there. And
but this was a real
problem. The whole thing is that no one really knew how to do it. I mean, they evolved tactics in the end. The Germans, I think at the Somme, put some of their crack tubes right at the front trenches, and they sort of, as soon as the firing stopped, they came up and warned everybody that, you know, it was dangerous things, and they just mounted the machine guns and mowed people down. But there was another. Jane, probably correct me on this, but I think the German trench dugouts were different from ours, were much deeper, and I think they were lined with concrete.
Much
so
better
they, in fact,
constructed.
Survived, eh?
Yes, much better constructed.
Yes.
But
the thinking on the British side the Allied side was so aggressive that they had the evidence that this was so, because it was obviously to and fro over the front trenches, but they just ignored it. And I remember watching that film about Five Bridges, Bridge Too Far, or there. And there was somebody who warned the high command that there were actually panzer divisions in Holland, and they ignored that as well, because it just they weren't going to spoil the show.
That
sort of psychology went on.
The Second World War, of course, and the Battle at Arnhem, which had Gene Hackman portraying the Polish general, something which I've often been tempted to actually use at times with various sort of instances in life, where you actually sort of wander up to the supposed leaders and say, just checking you're on our side.
I have to say, this idea that, you know, it was lions led by donkeys is now out of favour with historians.
Yeah.
You know, it used to be the case that people would say they were, you know, all the leaders were incompetent, particularly Haig, and didn't know what they were doing. In fact, historians challenge that now and say, you know, there's plenty of evidence actually that they assess very carefully, but like you say, Ian, it was technology was going faster than tactics, or they tried a number of things. They were constantly trying other things, but you know, the trench warfare thing, it really happened because the Germans invaded so quickly. Right along the line and got dug in. You know, they were there. They got the best position early in the war, and that was it. And that dictated the position thereafter. And And
just like the World Cup then, Jane, in many ways.
Oh, yes. I suppose so.
They did actually play a football match between the two armies, didn't they?
On the Christmas Day, it was there several, yes.
Yeah, they're told they couldn't have extra time, they're going to get shelled or something.
And don't start me on penalties, because that would have been a whole new still.
That's not funny, though, really. I mean,
here's something which clearly resonates. We think about 100 years now, depending on your particular time of life, that might seem as though it's thousands of years ago, 100 years. I remember as a child of the sort of 70s, you thought, Second World War, it's ancient history, really. But, of course, actually, it's couple of generations, three generations most, in terms of the way you're looking for it.
It's not just that, it's the fact it set the pace for the modern world. You know, this was the turning point.
It changed society.
It changed society so dramatically and so differently, sometimes not immediately. You know, it wasn't obvious immediately after the war. But if looking back on it now, we can say that this was a watershed between the old world and the new. And the legacy is huge over the whole 20th century and into today, all sorts of things.
Yes, I quite agree. And the book that I wrote, part of the theme was that the characters in the village were people who would probably never travel more than 10 miles from their homes during their whole lives.
Yeah, that would be accurate. Yeah.
And there were the big event would, there's one sort of comic incident where somebody tried to go to Alnwick for the market, to a marketplace, which was about 10 or 15 miles from where they lived, and fallen asleep on the train and actually went around in Scotland. So he's the furthest travelled member of the whole community. I mean, cast against their lives, there was this massive event that was going to change everything. Because I used the Friends Battalions to get half the village marching off to war.
Mm. Yeah.
And of course, they all die on the same day, of course.
And that Friends Battalion was really, on the one hand, if you're being very sceptical, an extraordinarily cynical attempt to kind of whip up as many troops as you could possibly get and become almost cannon fodder, Jane.
Well, yes, but if you look at the numbers, you can see why that was, you know, Kitchener did it that way. It's because we had a really tiny army at the outbreak of war, because we didn't have conscription.
Yeah,
and,
right.
You know, ours was a professional army, and it was way too small.
Yeah.
And we just needed a lot of people really quickly.
Yes. And if they thought that if their friends joined together, would fight together and fight for each other better. The horrible thing was that at the Somme, there were so many people killed and 20,000 people killed on the first day, wasn't it?
Yes, it's terrible.
So what happened was that you had huge communities were just absolutely slaughtered.
Yes.
So that they abandoned it after that, I think.
Considering the philosopher Sun Tzu's phrase, those who don't learn from history are doomed to repeat its mistakes, are we heading in a similar direction, Jane, from a perspective? I mean, occasionally, you know, obviously no army, cutbacks and all sorts of things.
Well, I mean, I prefer the phrase of Plato, I think it is, that if a person has not looked into history, they're still a child. And I think this is the battle we have these days, is persuading young people and others that actually there are some lessons and insights from history.
Yes.
You know, there are people that believe strongly, as I do, in heritage, but not everyone. And so I think, you know, it's a constant battle to remind people that the past is important. It's not going to repeat itself identically, but there are lessons to learn.
You know, what I found about my own life is that the older I got, the more interest I got in history.
Yes, I think that's true of a lot of people.
Yeah.
Except one important thing, Ian, you use the O term there. Remember, we don't use the O term on this show. It's called becoming more... we become either more experientially enhanced or chronologically gifted. You know, it's important. These are the exact things. We do not use the O term. It's, please.
Or chronologically challenged? No.
I think just chronologically gifted, really. It's become a way.
Well, I spoke to somebody once who said, I have three ages. I have my actual chronological age when I was born, my date of birth.
Yeah.
I have what's in my head. And what I feel like, and then I have what I look like as well.
Well, the last one is 24, Jane, I would
say. Oh. In my head, it's even younger.
Well, exactly.
Many a time I've cursed mirrors and photographs.
Come now, Ian. You're doing very well for a 96-year-old.
Poor Ian.
Moving on. When do you head off to Canada?
Later this month.
Right. So there's hopefully time to squeeze in another little review and reprise on the whole thing. And finally, we would be remiss in our duties if we didn't invite you to share your thoughts on the recent Brazil event. Did you feel overall justice was done with respect to the winners, or do you think those Argentinians, they were...
I think, by and large, the better team won the competition. I think the Germans were probably the best team in the competition. But I don't think, funny enough, although the actual football we saw was some of the most exciting I've ever seen in the World Cup, I don't think the actual quality of the teams involved were made. There was no great team, is what I'm trying to say, I think. Like, you know, the Brazil of the 1970 and the Dutch team, the 74, I think it was.
A definite line there. If you're interested in following through the adventures of Ben Lyndon, fastest bowler in history, fiction of course, before that he pushed a cart for a living. His life was put in jeopardy when the daughter of a peer fell for him. That's part of Gentlemen and Players, the latest Ian Lennox text. And of course, The Brothers, which we've been speaking about today, is available to download via Kindle and other devices, as much as anything else, and it's a fantastic tale as well. Ian Lennox, have you had a reasonably interesting telephonic link with us on the show today?
Yes, I have, and I really enjoyed it, thank you.
You see, that's something when you get Professor Jane Chapman on the screen. So I take it you'll be back with us again next week?
Yes, I will. Thank you.
A tenement, a dirty street, walked and worn by shoeless feet in silence.
Been a race theme in many ways today. Race as in running as opposed to other issues. Jane, I need to ask the question because I have seen that there is a fashion perhaps, but a notion to actually change the notion of history to herstory. Herstory? Yeah, in fact,
how do you mean?
As in the name change, because obviously we want to go for the feminine aspect of herstory.
Oh, herstory. I thought you meant Hearst, no, like William Randolph.
William Randolph. No, or Jeff, of course.
Yes.
And I just thought that seems a little bit pushing things too far.
It's a bit silly, isn't it?
I would have
really
thought so.
Yeah. But I mean, there is a trend towards more research into the role of women in history and women's contribution, which I think is tremendous. And I've made my humble contribution to that.
Absolutely.
But history is history, isn't it, I think?
I think so. I mean, there's some ways in which you can change things through, but still, who knows what could be happening. Now, we had hoped to be speaking to an organic baker called Sid Aston, who would be talking about a recent survey which revealed that in UK bread there's a high presence of pesticides that's actually involved there. Nothing has come through as yet. That doesn't mean to say that we won't be connecting. But
well, we can still talk about bread if you want.
Well, that's very true, exactly. I mean, what would you like to say about bread?
I wanted to say I've given up wheat.
Right.
So I only eat rye bread. Because I find that wheat raises your blood sugar and makes you feel a bit too full and kind of bloated. Particularly if I have a sandwich at lunchtime, I feel a bit too sleepy afterwards. So, I'm interested in sorts of bread that don't use wheat and indeed sorts of pasta that don't use wheat, like rice pasta, for instance. Rice noodles.
Nutrition is such an important and vital part of our current lifestyles and so on. And yet there is the time that during times of war, actually, our eating was a lot healthier. It's bizarre in many ways, even though rationing was in place in all sorts of other areas.
Well, it's true in the First World War, actually, in many ways, because, people were incredibly poor looking back in it. Do you know that the average working class diet... was the average working class diet was bread and tea, and they had very little meat and that kind of thing. Whereas during the war, the troops, what they ate was actually regulated. There was very strict regulation about the number of calories, etc. In the event, the troops didn't eat very well because a lot of the supplies didn't get to them. And so that was a logistical problem, if you like, which meant that they were over-reliant on what they call bully beef, which is corned beef, and really tough beef. biscuits. Although there was a rather nice tin stew called Macanoni. I can't pronounce it. Do you know it? A Scottish one, which was.
I could attempt it, yeah. But I don't. I think we'll leave it at Macanoni.
It was one of my East of England stories because it was actually originated there. So in some ways, you know, they were eating better in the First World War, the troops, than before. I looked a bit into living standards before the war because I did a piece for the BBC on setting the scene of what it was like in the East of England and Lincolnshire when the war broke out. And of course, there was much less population, and what population there were was much more spread out. There was a lot more space, less density, and a lot more rural. But did you know, for instance, if you wanted to buy a house in those days, it would cost you £200 or £300. But only 10% of people owned their own houses.
And of course, in Europe, that's still pretty much the figure because renting is very much the state of play over there.
Yeah, that's right.
And in terms of the response that you've had for obviously the BBC, I don't say challenge, but the project that was actually there,
yes.
Has it been beyond expectations, as expected, below expectations?
I think it's been beyond. The BBC have been really pleased by it. And one of the ways that we have at the BBC of measuring that is we've been doing a number of kind of road shows or live events.
I saw one at the Great Yorkshire Show last week.
Right, well, there we are. So I should tell you a little bit about it. They've selected various agricultural shows and the like the Great Yorkshire Show, to take a display. Mm-hmm. Was it a display? It actually consists of about...
Completely free of charge as well. It's fantastic.
Yes, free. About five marquees and caravans. One of the caravans has got all the gizmo, the TV cameras in. It's live, you know, outside broadcast. And people can go in and do their own television presenting. So that's quite fun. Another one is a recruitment tent for the First World War in the style of the period. And you can go in.
I very nearly got signed up, actually.
Oh, you did indeed. Wow. Did they take your photo, Alex?
Yes, they did. ID badges. You've got your ID badge as well.
That's right. A tremendous old, really old camera, which actually has got modern gizmo in it. So they take your photo to give you your recruitment card, and you get this recruitment card, which is like a replica. No, that's right. So I did that. That was quite a lot of fun as well. And then there's a tent where they have talks, like I was doing, by experts and music and performance and this kind of thing, with screens, so I could show my cartoons that I researched for the First World War with a talk. And I did talks on a rolling programme, and they approached it, the BBC, at these live events, like they would a magazine format, like we're doing now. So each person has 10 minutes or so, 20 at the most, and then there's a presenter, and then they come on to something else. So I was doing my talk. I have been doing my talk four or five times a day over two typically two-day live events. So I've got to do the same talk like 30 times so far, but in front of a total of getting near for now 50,000 people.
Yeah, indeed. And if people were wondering, well, why wasn't it at the Lincolnshire Show? It went to Skegness. I had nothing to do with it. That's just the way it was, okay?
Well, part of the thinking was to try and reach some areas that don't normally have as much. So I suppose they thought, well, the Lincolnshire Show is so well known, why don't we go to one that, you know, go to the edges a bit?
Well,
and, of course, these seaside resorts were really interesting in the First World War.
Absolutely. Well, it was really the height of their success in many ways in terms of, do you like to be beside the seaside and a whole range
of not just for the leisure of the seaside. I was thinking actually of the war at sea and the naval things and what have you, you know, a lot going on. And bombing, they were the first to be bombed in many cases.
For obvious reasons.
Skegness was very badly bombed.
More from Professor Jane Chapman and hopefully William Sitwell in a few moments on the Midweek Drive for Siren 107.3 FM. Still the same. Silver Bullet Band, and still the same. Hopefully still the same, with effortless style and panache, whether he's on his way to Lourdes or not, on a train somewhere. We've got ace culinary guru and, of course, editor of Waitrose magazine, William Sitwell. How are you, William?
Good morning, Alex. Good morning. Yeah, I'm on a Virgin train heading from Milton Keynes to Euston.
Oh.
And if we get cut off...
Yes, we blame Virgin.
Amuse yourself by reading my piece all about cheese in today's Telegraph.
What more could we ask for? A piece about cheese in today's Daily Telegraph. Fantastic stuff. We have Professor Jane Chapman in the studio, comparative media historian, Professor of Communications at the University of Lincoln, responsible for exhibitions at the Cartoon Museum, a whole heap of others, award winner in terms of televisual delights, film delights at the New York Film Festival.
I have filmed cheesemaking.
And cheesemaking film person, which is truly wonderful.
In the original village of Camembert.
In the original village of Camembert. Sorry, I don't know why I'm repeating her, William. You can perfectly understand what she's actually saying. Share with us. Have you actually done that yourself, as well, William? Checked out Camembert in Camembert?
I haven't, no, but I do recommend that people try out a bit of Cobbler's Nibble.
Cobbler's Nibble. What's Cobbler's Nibble?
It's a tangy... sort of cheddar-like cheese that is produced out of Northampton. Of course, it's called Cobbler's Nibble because it's what the cobblers like to nibble.
Yes.
Well, Northampton is a great town of leather production and shoe production.
Shoemaking, yes, that's right.
But you see, what the interesting thing is, I've been thinking about, Prince Charles said when he went around River Cottage, Hugh Fernley Whittingstall's amazing empire down in Axminster, he said that the cheese business has exploded over the last 20 years, and it is amazing because we've now got like 700 cheesemakers in this country, and we're not restricted like the French, who have rules and regulations as they do with wine. We have an extraordinary array of cheeses, and we're very lucky. So I think that we should get out there, get sniffing, get nipping.
Well, tell me, William, do you think we're close approaching the claim that General de Gaulle made for the French many years ago, that the French have a different cheese for every day of the year?
Well, I think they do, but we certainly do. We have, we're not far. We have at least two cheeses. We're not far from having two cheeses for every day of the year. We have 700. So you do the math. My math isn't very good.
But hold on. They may not all make different ones. Some of them make the same cheese, the same sort of cheese. So they could all make cheddar, couldn't they?
There's 700. We can nitpick, but I mean, but you can get different kinds of cheddar depending on the time of year, depending on how the cow was, depending on the grass that it ate. So there's many different kinds. In the same way that there's many different kinds of Chardonnay, there's very many different kinds of cheddar.
Right. What about my cholesterol levels then, William? What's cheese going to do for that? Cholesterol.
I don't give a damn about your cholesterol. What I'm keen on is how is the cheese tasting nice? Has it been matured well? Has it travelled well? Has the retailer looked after it? Does it go with this cracker? Will I be able to drink it?
These are the crucial questions, Jane.
Yes, I think the crucial one is which red wine do you have with it?
William, what cheese do you think our British lads, our English lads, will be doing in the Oval? Because you have to see them today, of course. It was a draw with India in the first test. What are your thoughts?
My thoughts on today's cricket?
Yes.
I just hope that we can stay in there and get some runs.
Right.
It's all about batting, isn't it? I mean, the thing is, I'm a bowler, so I love bowling. So I'm actually of no use because, as Jeff Boycott says, all about batting. You've got to get the runs. You've got to stick in there. I mean, it's going to be hot out there today. It's going to be warm, so people are going to have to, they're going to have to stay in there, and they've got to be strong because it's going to be hot, and there's going to be a roaring crowd behind England. Mind you, that we have a wonderful Indian community in this country, and they'll be roaring them on too. So it's going to be a pretty epic battle, I think.
And have you gone with a picnic, William? Have you got a culinary picnic there, or will you be availing yourself of the hospitality at Lord's?
Well, I don't think my friend Jacob Rees-Mogg, who's an MP for Somerset North, will mind if I let the nation know that he's giving me a lunch.
Yeah, that's okay. That's fine.
We'll be picnicking.
It's always nice to actually get a Rees-Mogg mentioned on the show, isn't it, Joe?
Well, yes, they're a very influential family.
Exactly. Much as the Sitwells, go to Edith and a whole range of things. William, we've managed to get the link in a one sort of wonderful wrap-up scenario, which is great. We've got one final question for yourself, actually three, but this one, a story we're doing with journalist and relationship writer Andy Jones, who claims that actually the car you drive could make a prospective partner more attractive. One in three people believe this. and one in five people would be more likely to go on a second date with someone if they had a new car. Jane has, as she admitted in the first part of the programme, a 19-year-old Mercedes.
So I'm not going to get any dates, am I?
What are your thoughts on this little survey, William? I think we might have lost him. We might have lost him before we could even say, has he had a reasonably interesting telephonic chat, and is he coming back again? Yeah, he's gone. There we are. I'm sure he will. Here are the birds.